All right. Good evening, everybody.
Hi.
Thank you for coming.
Hi.
Okay. Interesting that this class doesn't do prayer. Anyway, that's fine. Pardon? Oh, start with meditation. Okay, let's start with meditation then. All right. How long do you usually meditate for? Depends on the teacher. 5 minutes? Sounds great. Okay. So is it, how do you stop the meditation? With this here? Oh, the other way around, I guess. Right? Okay. All right. So let's just do 5 minutes of breathing meditation, I guess, mindfulness, right? Just whatever, whichever you feel more comfortable with, but usually just to calm the mind, to just watch the breathing in and out. Or if you have another image you would like to use, then you're welcome to do that. All right. well, actually, I think it's a good idea to do prayers before you do a practice. Well, not for today, because this is the way you do it, but actually, a prayer is also a type of meditation, and it's very important because at least do the refuge and bodhicitta prayer. I take refuge of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Well, until I'm enlightened, I take refuge of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. By the merits of practicing perfection, the six perfect, by the merits of meditating, may I attain a Buddha, the state of a Buddha, for the benefit of all sentient beings. Right, so that would be a good prayer to set the motivation, of course, with the bodhicitta part, but also taking refuge. Yeah, and then do the 5 minutes of breathing, and do whichever other meditation you do. But so for today, in particular, of course, I'd like to speak about practice, which does not just take place on the meditation cushion. We should try to do it all day long. I mean, the meditation cushion is a nice place. It's a place of comfort. It's a, you know, quiet. But that's almost like keeping healthy in the morning, just doing a little bit of running, right? I don't know however long you run or any kind of other physical exercise you would do, you know. And then throughout the day, you still keep healthy. You don't eat. You try to eat. You know, certain foods that keep you healthy, you try to do certain things to keep you healthy. So likewise with meditation practice, the morning practice, if you have the time, take some time, you know, 5 minutes if that's all you can spare. If you can do more, 15 minutes, half an hour, that's great. Yeah, take that time off. And during that time, it's good initially, and of course many of you have been practicing already for some time, but it's initially good to do mindfulness meditation, to practice mindfulness. There's still some seeds in the front here. Yes. So to practice mindfulness meditation, but that is not enough. Mindfulness meditation, it's great meditation. It's wonderful. It's very effective. But there are other meditations that we should also do because they really change the mind. I mean, mindfulness meditation can, of course, also changes the mind, but there's another way in which the mind is changed more drastically, right? Changed in a positive way. And that is, of course, with the Lamrim meditations. So that's what I was asked to speak a little bit about today, about how to do a daily practice, how to meditate on the Lamrim. And I'll go through some of the points so it becomes obvious. And for those of you who are not familiar with this, at least I mentioned the points and how we should maybe interpret them also into kind of thoughts we should generate in the 21st century. Because, of course, the Lamrim Shemo was written, for example, this text by Lama Tsongkhapa was written in the 15th century, 14th, 15th century. It's pretty old. I mean, yeah, kind of relatively old. So it still applies, but I think it's good to add a few things and understand what the meditation is for, and then we can be creative with our own kind of adding things to it. So mindfulness, just being in the moment, being mindful, is highly effective, especially when you're in a stressful situation, right? When there's a lot of stress, when you feel stressful, the mind is uptight, then what can be helpful is to just kind of watch the mind. You're mindful of the stressed out mind, as if you were taking a step back from your own mind. That's not what you're doing, actually. You just generate another type of mind that's looking at the other mind, just very calmly and relaxed, right? Or when you get upset, angry, again, take that moment and just look at the anger, right? Because the moment you start looking at the anger, your focus is on the anger and not on the object of the anger. Right? Maybe the stressful situation, someone who annoyed you. In that moment, just gently take the mind back and watch the anger. So it has two advantages. One, you get to know your own anger. You get to learn more about that stressful mind, that, you know, frustration, whatever it is, anger, frustration, sadness. But then the other good news is, or the other advantage is, it slowly starts disappearing. Because the force is taken off the anger, right? And to understand, it's just a state of mind. It's impermanent. It doesn't last. So when the causes and conditions come together, it's there. And then It focuses on a specific object that's usually outside of ourselves. Or, well, maybe it could also be our own mind, at least. You know, it could be that, or our own body, or our own situations. But then when you look at the anger itself, then the object is the anger. So it's like another mind that just looks at the anger in an objective way, and it dissipates. So that's a very effective way of dealing with these kind of difficult states. And it takes out some of the stress, because anger, frustration, they're not healthy. They chemicals are released in the body that are harmful to us, right? I mean, this is not something the Buddha said. I mean, the Buddha didn't talk much about that. But scientists, modern scientists, have found that to be the case, right? And you, most of you probably live a stressful kind of life. I mean, living a 21st century kind of life, it's very stressful, right? So that's one important point, I always feel. And I said this during some of the other lessons that I gave, that I learned a lot from just being around the Tibetans. And one thing I learned is they're always calm. I mean, it's very difficult to stress out a Tibetan. It's really, I'm the one who's stressed out, but they're not. It's kind of hard almost, Oh God, we need to catch the train. We need to be quick. We have to be. And they're like, all right, let's just catch the train. Oh, we missed the train. Let's have some tea. Let's see. They really find a way, and they don't like stress. They really don't like it. So when other people get stressed out, it's almost like they don't want to be around you. They want to just, they kind of take their leave a little bit, stay away a little bit, and then they chuckle among each other a little bit. Ooh, look at her. I mean, I tried to hide it, but it was always obvious. They were laughing about me. So anyway. So it's just a good way, just always. And I also learned this, I mean, initially I sometimes, like when I did my study, I was stressed out and I did too much. And I had to learn to find a balance. So to find a state where you don't do too much and not too little. I mean, the mind is just really tricky. Like sometimes I'm like, I really need to rest. I need to rest. I need to rest. Oh, it's so good to rest. And I rest forever, right? And I don't want to get up and I don't. So that's laziness. Right? So to identify when I'm doing too little and when I'm doing too much. So the moment you do practice and you feel your mind gets uptight, just let it go. Watch a movie. Have a cup of tea, coffee. Well, maybe not very strong coffee, because then it comes to that. But kind of light coffee, right? Or maybe decaf or whatever. Yeah? And just do anything that usually relaxes you. Okay? And then gently go back. So this is really important. This is very, very important. And I've heard, some of you may have heard of Jetsoma Tenzin Palmo, the great meditator nun, the British nun, yeah. We go to see her usually with the Emory students who come and do a study abroad program. So we go to see her every year. And one year I remember she gave some advice. She gave us some advice. And she talked about what scientists have found, that usually there's kind of a balanced state that most of the time we're in, right? There's a balanced state. We usually, a kind of state of contentment, if you like, or some kind of usual state. And sometimes it's elevated by some great event. And then something not so nice happens, And then again, it goes back to that usual level, right? You may all be familiar with that. If you really look over time, something bad happens and for a day or two you're upset. But even though the problem persists, you go back to the kind of usual state, right? Something negative. Sorry, I should do this movement. Something negative happens and you go back. And something great happens, I don't know, you fall in love or you win some money or, get this new car. Ooh. And then it becomes normal again, right? And they say that with practice, as a meditator, if you do constant practice, you actually, this ordinary level goes up, it becomes a little higher. There's more level of it's like you're more content, you're happier, you're higher up in terms of your moods. So this is something you could start observing. Years back, maybe it was kind of like more of a dull state, the usual state, or not really, not, it's kind of okay. But then over time, it became a little better, and there was more happiness and contentment. So this is usually good to know as a instigate, advertisement for meditation. But it's true. I mean, it's not even, you know, exaggerating or lying about it. And this is what scientists have found. And His Holiness nowadays, when he explains meditations and so forth, he always mentions the physical kind of happening. He always talks about that. So I think that's important to understand, that scientists have really found that to be the case, that our general usual state will be elevated, more happiness. Okay. So this is about stress, right? Kind of, right, not doing too much, not doing too little, trying to reach some peaceful state of mind. And sometimes maybe there's someone you notice they can do it. Watch them, right? In my class, it was the same. Some were calmer, others, and I would watch them. You can so often learn from other people. And even they're not Buddhists, you know, maybe. I mean, it doesn't mean that. I know lots of people who are much better Buddhists than I could ever be, but they're not even Buddhists. I mean, they're much better practitioners. So, you know, you don't have to call yourself such or, you know, believe in everything that Buddhism talks about. But you just watch them. They're actually practicing that. So watching them is also very inspirational. I found that with my classmates. Okay, they happen to be Buddhists. They happen to be monks. But some were better, than others. And Tibetans are also great with taking things with humor. They love to laugh about themselves. The best joke, you make a mistake, you tell others, it's great. You make a funny mistake, you can tell everyone, that's great, right? And you fall in front of other people, they're all laughing. You're like, great, I gave them, of course then they pick you up, but the first thing is they first laugh. They take everything with humor, right? So it's great, this kind of sense of humor. Yeah. I had one classmate, he used to always get angry. He was very, very angry, right? Initially, he was a new monk, he got always angry. And then people were like, when he got angry, they were like, and one time the story goes that he'd thrown a tape recorder, his most prized possession, he had thrown against the wall. So that was the best thing. So we kept saying, you know, hold the tape recorders, he's angry, and he tape recorded us around. And you know, and then before he couldn't help it, after a while he was laughing, you know, he finally thought it was really happening, really funny, and he couldn't get angry anymore. And then over the years we would watch him, you know, the anger was gone. So it was always like humor was always very important. So I think humor is great. And if you feel stressed out, maybe just get a funny movie. You know, watch one of those funny shows. I mean, they say it's like really effective, just the laughing. And okay, in Tibet they didn't have those, so they would just hang out with their friends and things would be fine. So nowadays maybe we don't have, you know, those kind of jolly friends. Well, maybe just watch a movie. The end result is the same. You get to laugh when the stress goes, right? Okay, so I think that's important because the stress comes from the mind, really, right? We make our own stress. We believe so much in what we perceive. Not understanding is just a creation of our mind. But that takes time to understand that. So for me, usually, or what I think is usually most important, to just find this calmness. And there's so many different techniques that show you how to do that. But one important technique I find is when you look at the Lam Rim, so the different topics that I explained, but I personally usually like the beginning topics. I found them for my mind most effective, right? I mean, surely there are some other topics such as emptiness and bodhicitta. They're highly advanced. And as to look at them and deal with them is still important. You want to do the whole thing. I mean, you could do maybe the one prayer with this called Foundation of All Good Qualities, which takes into consideration all the points of the Lam Rim. It's got everything. So it gives like a good sense where you're going. It takes, you know, all the points into consideration and you know where you're actually going. But then maybe to focus on the basics because they're most effective. Right? It's not about quantity, it's all about quality. So what is not the first topic, what is the second topic of the Lam Rim Chemo, of the steps when you start meditating? What is the second topic? Precious human rebirth, right? So relying on the teacher, okay, that can maybe be left aside for the moment. It's still important, but this is almost, well, it's like you look for a teacher, so that's why you kind of start to encounter the teachings. But in a way, there are other ways in which we can encounter the teachings nowadays. We can, you know, read about them. We can, you know, look, check online and go, you know, and perceive, watch teachings there, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama's teachings, and kind of slowly approach that topic and, you know, check whether we want to rely on someone like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, for example, or of course, Lama Sopa Rinpoche. But then the next topic is so important, precious human rebirth. So important. And we need to first understand why it's important. It is important to get a good self-image, a positive self-image. Now, trust me, Tibetans have a positive self-image. They don't really have a problem with self-acceptance, you know, or self-confidence. I don't know. I don't know exactly why, but I guess it's they were not raised in this kind of high-pressure society. I mean, many of them were raised in Tibet, and even though there's also some pressure there, but the culture doesn't put pressure on their kids, for example. It has disadvantages, of course. Sometimes there's not enough emphasis on education outside of the monastic education. There's definitely that disadvantage. And now in the schools, they're trying to foster competitiveness. This would be abandoned in America. No way. But it's still not that effective. You know, like when they take exams, outside forever you have a board, number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, and 3 are highlighted. And then they have like a celebration where everyone's result is being read out in class with a name. And then number 3 gets up to get a present and everyone claps moderately. And number 2 gets up and everyone claps harder. And number 1 gets up and they go, whoa! And so they don't really care if they're number 1, 2, or 3. It's like, you know, they rejoice for number 1, so like everyone is so happy for number 1. So it's really not this, they have more of like this rejoicing is very much part of their culture. So it's like, oh great, you know, I didn't do that, I didn't work that hard, but he did, how great. So it works a little bit, but it's not as effective. And in the West, I think, oh my God, you know, students would probably get suicidal, unfortunately. I mean, it's just, you know, the extent of ambition and so forth. So just to get that sense of how Tibetans are really not, they have really strong self-confidence, and being good in school and getting high marks, well, it doesn't really, you know, scratch their self-confidence much. And so also something I shared with you before, and many of you may have heard this, this is the example, this is Holiness the Dalai Lama, but I'm sure there are other Tibetans. When some scientists tried to explain His Holiness the concept of self-hatred, His Holiness didn't know what they were talking about initially. At least that's, you know, how His Holiness manifested. Like saying, what is it? And so they had to take some time off to explain what self-hatred is, right? And so other Tibetans, if you say self-hatred, it's like, and it seems almost contradictory that we have self-hatred and we have strong ego. It's almost like if you have self-hatred, you can't have a sense of an ego, right? It's like, it's almost like, oh, does this person realize selflessness because they don't like themselves? It's almost like, are they less? No, it actually comes out of a stronger sense of a self, which we have in the West. It's been fostered, right? It's like, not only do we have a natural sense of I, me, and mine, but then it's actually by the culture, it's being strengthened. Definitely it's being told that there, well, in some systems there's an idea of some separate self, like a soul, for example. Then Freud's ego, superego, you know, and then what? Be someone in this world. Do something. What was the commercial I saw at McDonald's? Do something good for yourself. Drink the pumpkin latte or something. I forget now. I still don't know what pumpkin latte is, but I keep seeing pumpkin latte wherever I go. I don't know what latte and pumpkin have. Anyway, but it's like, do something for yourself. Be kind to yourself. Have that latte, pumpkin latte thing. And it's like, so interesting, right? Or this Coca-Cola commercial where this guy kind of comes down in a helicopter to a store to drink Coca-Cola. Be who you are or something. It's like always like, it's like this kind of fostered, right? This kind of be someone in the world. So then on top of that, we get this illusion of perfection is possible, right? We can be perfect. Buy the perfect, I don't know, hamburger, and you're the perfect housewife, or you're the perfect husband if you drive this car, or you're the best, you know, the best student if you wear those jeans. I mean, it's always this kind of illusion of perfection, and it's subconscious. Right? We get this illusion of being perfect. And I meet so many students every year, the Emory students come, this illusion of they want to be perfect. They want to do it perfectly. If they don't understand a point in the Dharma, it's like, I can't get it. I'm not perfect. Right? It's not conscious. It's almost like it's subconscious. Right? It's subconscious. Anyway, so therefore, if we can't live up to it, we hate ourselves. It's just that. We can't forgive our own failure. Right? I keep saying that. My best friend, that's all right. You can fail. It's okay. It's okay. We're very accepting of our friends, our neighbor, of they can fail. But not me. My failure is not okay. My success is important. So it's a bit like, why is this, why can't we not, I mean, failure, you know, success, it's relative anyway. What is failure? What is success? I mean, it's just the names we give those things, right? There's no really inherent. It's like what we even call it. And then we believe it to be true. And, oh, it's so permanent. And we will always be, oh, you know, it's like the sense of permanence and solidity. And that is good. It's just made in our own mind. And we suffer so badly, right? And start hating ourselves. Yeah. And oh, it's just, it's so sad in the West. And it's so many illusions there. So this is the understanding this, it's just, we create this, and it doesn't mean it's less real. Of course, it's very real, yeah? But meditating, understanding, looking inwards, you know, in a way which we haven't done before, allows us to see, wow, we're amazing people. We have already now incredible qualities, and we have such potential. We have such an incredible mind. We just don't know how to use it right now. So precious human rebirth, that allows us to see our inner strength, to see how great we are. You know, to get rid of this kind of self-hatred and all that. To understand, to look the things we take for granted in everyday life. You know, I mean, what I'm sometimes reminded of, you know, like, I can do certain things, and I never think of this every day. You know, things, and I'm never grateful for them. But then, I don't know, I get a cold or something, you know, and I feel crappy for a few days, and I can't do the things I can usually do, right? And then I recover, and for a day or two, I'm so blissed out. I'm so happy. Why? Because suddenly I appreciate what I usually can do, you know, I can function, you know, I can do the things, definitely practice the Dharma. But then, just a bad cold can keep you from just, you know, organizing your mind and be focused. And so then I thought, oh my God, I never really rejoice in what I have. And you know, the things, when I don't have them, then I realize, oh, there's, you know, and so a great way is to rejoice in the mind and the body we have, right? I mean, it's not perfect, but it doesn't matter. We can still do the things that we can do usually. I mean, we can do so much with it, and especially the mind, right? We have a mind. I mean, okay, sometimes things are difficult, but still, we have much more wisdom, much more understanding than animals have, for example, right? I mean, we can meditate. We've encountered, of course, certain beliefs. We don't hold views. I don't think there's anyone who holds views that being a millionaire is the only important thing in the world. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here, right? So, we have a mind and body that allows us to do. Well, to do something to enhance our mind, right? We can do that. So to really rejoice in that and not focus on the negative. We keep doing this. We're so wired to just look at the bad stuff, right? And it's there, yes. But first of all, it's not permanent. It's changing all the time, right? And moreover, not just is it changing all the time, but also there's so much good. Okay, so to learn to focus more on that is so important. And we can do it. Like I said, when we're sick, right, we're really sick and we can't do certain things for a few days, and then we get better, and the first day we're like, wow. So that joy is not imagined. It's because we appreciate what we have in that moment. So just to remind ourselves, you know, every day, oh, I got that ability. I got that mind I can use. So important, right? I can use this. I can, yeah. So that's very important. So that's part of the precious human rebirth, okay? And other things, I don't hold these really strong, wrong views. I mean, how unfortunate, if you think of those people who just look at the external, just their beauty is the most important part. Oh my God, the money they spend in all these beauty products, you know, and the worry of growing older. I mean, we all have a worry to some extent, but it must be so hard to do all these surgeries, you know, keep that face young, have that knot in the back, you know, like just kind of pulling it back. And I mean, it's hard. It's a lot of suffering, right? And always have to look perfect and bad hair days. Oh, my God, you know, they're serious, right? So anyway, I mean, we don't have those reviews. I mean, you wouldn't be here. You'd probably be in a spa, right? I know. Or at the, cause, what do you call it? The lady who does all the, or the man who does all the, yeah, right? Those. So we would be there. So again, I mean, it's such a impermanent thing that we, you know, try to make permanent. Oh my God, what a futile endeavor, right? Anyway, so this is something to rejoice in, these incredible qualities we have. And I think it's a good idea to sometimes, just when we feel depressed and unhappy, you know, when things go wrong, maybe just take time and focus on that. Really take time. Oh my God, you know, all these abilities I have. And it gives us incredible inner strength. And that's important. We need inner strength. To do Dharma practice effectively, we need inner strength. So it gives us inner strength and confidence. Right now, we need it from others. And since everyone needs it, not everyone is willing to give it. They want it from us, but they don't necessarily want to give it, right? So, I mean, even if we have to always rely on others, it's you know, it's like, it's much better if we can give it to ourselves, okay? And others, they may see our good qualities and be jealous and totally not say anything, right? So it's like, whatever the reasons, or they may not identify them, or they're so preoccupied with their own problems. I mean, we can't wait for that. So we can give it to ourselves. We know ourselves better than anyone. So to look inwards and go through these steps that are given here. Okay, some of them are a little difficult. These are difficult. I mean, they take into consideration, for example, when you take the precious human rebirth, you have the 8 leisures, they're called, right? Okay, some, they really apply to Tibetans, you know, to being in a land where the Dharma spreads, you know, where the Dharma is the main religion. Okay, that's not. But it's only for Tibetans. There's another one, having a male body. They now changed it into very, very skillfully having a human body. It used to be a male body. I know it's a male body. Definitely in the Tibetan text, it's definitely a male body, right? Sometimes in the translation now, they're very careful about saying a human body. But really, it's a boy's, a man's body, right? So these things changed. I mean, yes, maybe in India, you know, in certain areas, in certain, women didn't have the freedoms. They couldn't just leave their home and do, you know, practice. Or they were very much under the control of their fathers, brothers. And there still are so many women in the world, right? But in 21st century America, I think it's not totally equal, but pretty much men and women, I would say, have the same opportunities. And it's not, you know, anyone can practice the Dharma, really, right, if they just want to. Of course, some people are not. I mean, if they're in a very difficult situation, like financially, they have to work all the time, they have no, okay, that's a different matter. So the point is here, some of these are a little difficult, some of these points. So we need to understand, what is the idea of the precious human rebirth meditation? It's to gain this idea, to see the positive things in our life, right? And really appreciate them and stop this habit of just focusing on the negative and blowing it up. Because not only do we look at the negative, we then dwell on it, and you know, it make it bigger and bigger. It becomes bigger and bigger the more we think about it, right? It's so typical, like someone says something negative to us. I talked about this in one of my talks before, and I'm talking about this from my own experience, that someone said one sentence that out of my attachment or whatever, I took very seriously, right? If I didn't even dare to tell someone because I knew the other person was going to say, so? So right? I knew they wasn't going to get any sympathy, so I didn't even share it. So that, but in my mind, it was getting bigger and bigger, and it felt like this dark cloud. You know, slowly, it became like a dark cloud, and the colors were not as bright anymore, the food didn't taste as good anymore, and every now and then, I would forget, and suddenly I would think, what was it? There was something wrong today. Oh yeah, that. I sometimes would forget and just be happy, and then like remember, oh no, I'm not happy today, because of that sentence, right? And the sentence, those words, had taken on a totally different reality, which I gave them. Thank you very much. You know, kind of carrying them around. So this is the habit. That's so we should replace it maybe. You know, someone smiled at us in the supermarket. Wasn't that kind? You know? Right? Or someone said something a year ago. So bad, it doesn't matter. A minute ago or a year ago, they said it. And kind of think about that and turn that into a pink cloud. just replace that. I mean, you know, why do we do it with something negative? Which maybe in the end we find out actually didn't talk to us, but talked to the neighbor. Wouldn't that be funny? Right? They weren't actually talking to us. I mean, that also happens. We spend a whole day working with that cloud to understand. Oh, actually, they didn't use that word. They used a different word. I just misunderstood. It's so bizarre, right? So unnecessary. So the trick is really to sometimes look for the good stuff, right? See the whole picture. Don't just focus. And it's a lot of the time we don't see the whole picture. There's also the vocabulary is used in Tibetan of narrow-mindedness. There's like a narrow-mindedness to our habits. We don't see the whole picture, right? We don't see the whole picture. Yeah. And from a Buddhist point of view, we only see just one life. Now, this is difficult. I can say that to Tibetans easily. And they go, yeah, there's so many lives, right? We'd be reborn and, you know, there's, you know, many, many lives and we had lives before. That's a little harder for Westerners. Who struggles with past and future lives? Raise your hands. Okay. All right. Okay. So, you know, and I'm part of that. I still, you know. No, you know, I think I'm very convinced. I'm really convinced about past and future lives. But every now and then I hear a story about, like, a child, maybe in India. It's kind of, in India, it's very funny. You read the newspaper, like, in the front page. It's like, oh, so-and-so just remembered their past life. And he went to visit his parents in this village. And they were very happy because the son came back. In the West, it'd be like, child has been admitted to mental institution because of imaginative kind of, you know. I don't know, I'm just kidding, I wouldn't be in the newspaper. But in India, it's very much matter of fact, you know. Like, I still remember reading the story about this boy who said, like, I live in this family, you know, and this is my home. The family had never eaten, his present family hadn't even heard about the place. And they took him to the place where he wanted to go, and he was always scared of tractors. It was this great fear. And then they went to this village, and they found this family, exactly the name, everything, and they found out they had a little son who was killed by a tractor. Yeah, so there's not more detail to this story, but amazing stories like that. So I hear these stories and go, wow, there really is past and future lives. I catch myself thinking that. It's like, so even myself, you know, being in this tradition for so long, I truly believe it. But it's not as deep as I would want it to be, right? But what I find helpful is to think there's a 50% chance there is past and future lives. There's a 50% chance, right? So either there's just this one life, all right, okay. Yeah, I mean, that gets a little difficult to explain things. But there's also a 50% chance it continues on. And if it continues on, let's take that into consideration, why am I so obsessed with just the happiness of this lifetime? Right? I mean, how often do we just work for the happiness of this lifetime and not of the happiness of future lifetimes, right? I mean, we can't take anything with us. Wealth, you know, reputation, or our body, can't take any of that with us. So why we're so? I mean, that's usually the things we're preoccupied with, right? Of course, to some degree, we need to live a, you know, but we sometimes exaggerate it, right? Can't take any of that with us. So anyway, this idea of being more broad-minded. And if there really is past and future lives, well, we could be reborn. Maybe we're not born as humans anymore. It could be possible. I mean, from a Buddhist point of view, we may be reborn in one of the other realms, which are not as good as the human realm. So to rejoice that we're human, that's the point. So to rejoice, really, we're human. I mean, we look around, there's so many animals, and they just try to, you know, survive. It's just bare survival every day. But even if we have a problem with thinking of that, there are human beings who live like animals. Really live like animals. I mean, in India, there are people who really live, they beggars, I mean, American beggars, I don't sometimes know. When they come up with a cup, I'm like, what does that mean? And like in New York, sometimes people come up, look really well dressed, and I wanted a dollar. And I'm like, well, what does he want a dollar for? You know, I didn't understand. Or didn't say a dollar, but like, you know. And then he said, like, I don't eat. I don't have not enough to eat. And I'm like, oh my God, what's going on? He looks like, but they look well dressed. I mean, definitely they have a problem, otherwise they wouldn't do it. But in India, the beggars, I mean, you can see it. You can smell it. I mean, it sounds bizarre, but they have no opportunity to ever wash themselves. They have nowhere to stay. They're in rags, you know. I mean, they really live like animals. It sounds horrible, but oftentimes their parents, they would buy as kids, they buy these blankets which have leprosy in them somehow. You can cure it, but they would put them around the children so they develop leprosy, so then they can effectively beg. I know it sounds horrific, but that's the truth. There's millions of people who, you know, not millions of beggars in India, but there's so many beggars. There's such poverty. And that's part of reality, right? To look around and see, oh my God, there are really people who live like animals. How fortunate I am, I don't have to live like that, right? So even if we cannot think, all right, there's maybe other existences that could be reborn there, well, at least, right? Think of it that way. So these are some of the steps in the Lamrim Shembo, for example, in the Lamrim text. We're not born as animals. And even as humans, we don't live like animals, right? We're cared for. We can care, you know, for ourselves. We can eat good, healthy food. Yeah, we don't have to live in rags and live on the bare minimum and survival every day. I mean, the beggars are treated so badly. Even the dogs attack them. Even the dogs attack the beggars. Why? Because the beggars are scared of the dogs. They throw stones at them. And because the beggars never wash themselves, they have a specific smell. So the dogs remember this one beggar that threw stones at them, and then they attack the next beggar. So even the dogs attack the beggars, right? Oh, it's just horrific. And then the children, they have no opportunity to really think about this. I mean, from the point of view of compassion, it's very effective to think of that. But it's like oftentimes we're so... just focus on one little sentence, like myself. The one sentence, Kesawamo sucks, right? And then there are beggars on the street in India, and they're, you know, and someone said Kesawamo sucks, right? It's like, come on. There are other things that are much more important. So, in terms of animals, then there are hungry ghosts. Okay, are there really these beings who are always hungry, like hungry? We don't know. But then there are people who are all never satisfied. You know, that would be similar in this world. There are people who are never satisfied. They get one thing and they want more, right? They want more, right? Maybe never have what they need, but also they have what they need and they're never happy. What a life! You can never relax. You can never be happy with what you have. You always have to continue shopping. We don't have that, right? Yeah, and if you don't have the money to do that, you're always unhappy because you want this and you can't have it. Even if you have the money, there's no joy in getting something anymore. Again, how wonderful you're not like that. And the people like that, I mean, we just need to look around a little bit. And then there's what else? Oh, the hell realms. Okay, I don't know if they're hell realms or not. I mean, I said it's just a state of mind, basically. I mean, we are born in an environment which has to do with our mind. The reality we perceive comes from our own mind, right? So there's no external kind of independent reality. It comes from our own mind. So because of whatever happened in the past, you know, some beings experience everything as great suffering. Right? That's great suffering. I've heard of, and this is very sad, and I don't want to upset someone. I was told when I said this to the Emory students, I should be a little careful about this. Never, I don't know what I should say. But there's certain, never mind, you're adults. So it's just like there's certain diseases where someone experiences the sensation of being burned. Of being burned alive. So they weren't burned alive, but that was the sensation they had. For them, that was reality. There are certain nerval disorders, and I'm not giving you the details because they're children present. But anyway, so the point is that people have these diseases where they have unbearable pain. So that's very real for them, this pain, right? So again, I mean, they cannot do anything. They basically cannot do anything, right? They cannot use their mind. They don't have that. Again, we don't have that. We're not in that situation. We can use our mind to, you know, think about things, relax and so forth. So there's so many problems around us, so many difficulties to rejoice in what we have. I think that's so important. That's the first step. Okay? And we've encountered a system that maybe we can't accept everything. We have lots of questions, which is good. Right? If you have questions and doubts, that's good. I mean, that would be, if I have never had doubts, it would be very difficult to do the studies I did. I mean, you couldn't have done the studies. You need questions. You need to have doubts, right? So it's actually a good thing to have doubts and questions and to take the things that you find helpful and kind of focus on them. And what we just talked about, that's common sense, right? It is expressed in a weird way, maybe, weird way, because it was a different time and a different time and a different culture. But we need to read between the lines and understand it's just to get more self-confidence and feel better, gain more inner strength by looking at our opportunities. Yeah, this is so important, especially in the West. Tibetans can do this so well, and still, it's still the first topic. So it means, you know, we need to really spend some time. So, what else? What else? I need to remind myself. So we're born in a religious country. All right, okay. It says religious country. Actually, it doesn't say that in Tibetan. Where Buddhism is the main religion, okay? It's a religious country, yeah, but Buddhism is not the main religion. So again, it just needs to be interpreted according to, you know, what's important. So what's important is we have the ability to encounter, you know, certain teachings that help our mind. We have not committed any strong, strong negativity in this lifetime, because probably if we had, we'd be in prison, right? And we would not have the freedom to do what we have or what we can do right now, okay? I mean, it says like the five heinous crimes, you know, have killed our parents or have tried to kill a Buddha or have, you know, caused a schism in the Sangha. I don't think anyone has done this. So, I mean, again, you know, we haven't done anything so negative that would really, you know, disturb our minds strongly, yeah? So, We were born at a time when Buddhism is around. And so, I mean, you can read through all the points. I don't need to go through all of them. But you can make up your own. Make up your own, right? I know this is this kind of phrase, count your blessings, but that is so important, to rejoice in your own. So this would be something, if you wanted to Dharma practice, practice that point. Really, practice this. And Lama Zopa Rinpoche, I told some people about this yesterday. He one day did this meditation. I'd never heard about that meditation. That's so typical for Lama Zopa Rinpoche, because he does these really intense, incredible, effective meditations that they're not in the scriptures, but because Rinpoche understands exactly what is the point, why we should do something, he comes up with his own unique kind of techniques. So one time, what he made us do was, there was like a puja. And people who know when there's a puja taking place, there's usually hours and hours of meditation and advice and so forth, right? And even the advice, you can take it like a meditation, okay? You try to take it like a meditation. You try to listen to it and try to meditate at the same time. So he said, let's all meditate now. Now, just rejoice in your own good qualities. Conjure up this joy in your heart. And everyone can do that, right? We can just conjure up joy. My good qualities. And you know, and you do this once, you do it twice, and new connections are made in your brain, you know, you leave imprints, whatever you want to call it, and you do it the first day, you can do it better and better. So you just made us sit there, right? And all these people, like in this gompa, more than here, many more. And I kind of looked around slowly, I was going to see. Nuns always sit in the front, so I'd look back, and I was like, you know, these faces of like smiles on their faces. And then Rinpoche took it from there and just rejoice and rejoice. And people could really do it. And then rejoice in the people in these rooms, their success, their happiness. And we just did this. And I was like, wow, this felt like a really long time. But I guess also Rinpoche's presence. It was amazing. I spent really, for the first time in my life, I spent like 30 minutes rejoicing. And I felt so good afterwards. Whatever my worries were, they were all gone. Because I'd totally... My whole mind was just, what's the word, flooded with this joy, right? Whereas it's usually flooded with worry, but that's my choice. Well, in this case, Rinpoche kind of made me do that. So, but I can, you know. So this is something we can all do. It's all in our own hand, and the power of the mind is such. So this is the first topic. And this, do you have to sit down on a meditation cushion? Do you have to be in a quiet place? Do you have to have incense, which maybe is not that cheap because it comes from, I don't know. You don't need any of that. You don't need it. You need to sit cross-legged? Not at all. You can be sitting in the car, driving, you know, be in a traffic jam. Great, you know. Or, I don't know, while you're in the subway. Is there a subway here? I'm not sure. No subway. Okay, whatever, wherever you are, in the bus or wherever you are, right? It's brushing your teeth on the toilet, you know. Whatever you do, you could just do it there and then. So you wake up in the morning and rejoice. I'm alive. I didn't die during the night. That's a lot. That's great, right? Didn't die during the night. That's amazing. People die in their sleep. But I woke up alive, and there's a new day. Just that in itself is so, you know, be so happy about it. So many opportunities, a new day. And then, oh, maybe the sun is shining. Oh, wonderful. Oh, it's not shining. Still great. You know, whatever. Coffee. Oh, smell of coffee. Just enjoy the smell of coffee, right? Just enjoy that cup of coffee. So much happiness around us. But the problem is we worry about the future already, or we kind of upset about the past. We're never in the moment, enjoy the smell of that coffee, and just kind of having a hot shower, right? Great. The hot water just makes you warm, and the smell of the nice soap, and right? I mean, actually, coming from India, you really enjoy that. We only have bucket water, you know, and then there's sometimes no water, so you have to carry a bucket before you get there, and then you're hot and sweaty, and then you have a cold shower, and the soap doesn't smell that good, and okay. So here, you can really enjoy. So you can do that every morning. How lucky, right? And what else? I mean, there's so much else, right? Anyway, so that's the first meditation. So we can all do that. So go through these points, but read between the lines. Understand what's the purpose of this, and then you can do it. And then, at some point, when you feel you really rejoice, and you feel you have inner strength, and, you know, things look much better, then go to death. But it may not last. So right now, I have all these opportunities, but I could die any time, right? Okay, again, 21st century, we don't really think about death. It's not fashionable to discuss it on the dinner table. You know, it's just not part in the advertisement and so forth. It's scary. But since we have to do it anyway, might as well think about it, because it's going to come one day and better be prepared, right? I mean, again, in India, it's so much part of life. I mean, the Tibetans even say, it's good luck to see a corpse. So when the corpse is carried out, people want to see it because it's good luck. But you know why they say it's good luck? It's just for people not to get scared, because it reminds us of impermanence, right? I mean, 100 years from now on, none of us will be around. Well, maybe an odd one or two who kind of live in 118 or something, or 108 years old or something, right? But other than that, I mean, we all be dead. Right? Maybe somewhere else. I mean, from a Buddhist point of view, we continue in a different form, but, you know, we won't be around. Might as well get used to it. And the moment we were born, we race towards our own death. Today's our youngest day. We don't get any younger than today. And every moment we get... So to get used to that, I mean, I think... And once the fear is gone, then it's almost like, why do I worry about certain things so much? You know, one day I just move on. So I don't need to worry about so many things. Many of our worries will be gone by just considering, huh, yeah, one day it's gone, right? It's not that important. I can't take any of this with me. Okay, reputation, money, you know, our comfort. I can't take any of that. My friends and loved ones. Well, that's scary, our friends and loved ones. But we meet them again, right? We actually meet them again. I usually say jokingly, but it's actually not a joke. There's no love on first sight. When we say there's love on first sight, well, we've probably been with that person before. When we just kind of, when we meet them again, we kind of quickly connect with them again. Why with this person and not someone else? They say something about the smell and so forth, but I don't know, honestly. It's like, oh, like that one, love on first sight. I mean, there's something with smell that helps, you know, and body helps too, you know, like shape and whatever, and what they say and so forth. That all helps. But really, I mean, from a Buddhist point of view, we probably were already together with them in a previous life, and we reconnect. So this is just life. We separate, we come together. It's like everything that comes together separates. Okay, but everything that separates also comes together again. So why are we so worried? You know, it's like we leave behind our loved ones, but we will also meet them again. And now, you know, our children go to university and then come back for Thanksgiving, right? And then they leave again and then come back, you know. So it's a bit like that. Our whole lives are like that. So what we're so scared of, you know, not encountering our loved ones again, we will, maybe in a different form, right? So anyway, so we worry so much because we think that's just this one thing, but there's so much more, right? And death is really not that scary if we, you know, look at it. See, here, like near-death experiences, people have beautiful experiences. They come back and they're totally changed and they're not scared anymore. That very much convinces me. I've heard interviews with people who had near-death experiences, and I said, I'm not scared anymore. That was such a beautiful experience I had, right? And whatever they encountered, whatever they, now they say the brain does this, this, this. Well, I don't care. The brain does such and such. It still happens. So there may be the fear initially, but when you're actually dying, they say there's an incredible experience of bliss and happiness, right? And then we move on. So again, why we're so scared, but taking that into consideration. So we have all this opportunity, we have all this, but we may lose it, right? Because yes, we die and then we don't know what comes afterwards. Yeah. So, and that takes us, yeah, yeah, that's also good. It's good to kind of, okay, right? But it's reality. The problem is when we don't live in accordance with reality, but that is reality. It is, and we can choose to ignore it, but sooner or later it will catch up with us. So the fear is the thing that is worse. Death is not so bad. The fear is worse. And some of these great meditators, you know, like one of the most beautiful stories that I've heard is these meditators are so in touch with that. You know, they're so accepting of their own death. There's a story of this great meditator who was like, okay, these things in this life, you know, I can't take them with me. And the older he became, the more of a sense, oh, let just others enjoy them, you know? Let others enjoy them. And in the end, just before death, he kind of knew his end was drawing closer because he was so in touch with his own body and his mind. He was kind of always looking inward. So he knew his time was coming to an end. So he gave away all these things and he said, might as well take me to the funeral ground already. So I might as well walk there on my own. And he said, like, might as well walk there on my own so I don't need to hassle someone having to carry me there. And his friends were like, no, we'll take care of things, don't you worry, right? But he was really, like, so accepting of it. So I could never be like that, you know. At this point, I can never be. But it's something to live towards. I think it's beautiful to have that attitude. It's going to come anyway. Might as well go with ease, right? Okay. And then there's some other topics. But another topic, and I don't want to go into this, the other topic is thinking of the suffering in the lower realms. And we've already a little bit done that, but maybe think of, you know, the suffering and problems of those less fortunate than ourselves, right? Think about those problems. And not just, you know, external problems, but also their internal problems, their inability to open themselves up to something meaningful and so forth, their hatred, you know, like serial killers or dictators, tyrants, you know, oh my God. I mean, maybe it'd be great to be the president of a certain country, but all the negativity, all the worry, you know? I mean, I hear the presidents of the United States, their hair turns gray really quickly, right? I mean, who wants to be, it sounds great to live in the White House and have all that great food and dinner, but I don't know. I mean, you know, if people like, go, Mr. President, wherever you go, but honestly, you know? And then if you're a good president, you try, but then some people are, you know, hungry for power and they want to fight wars and they, you know, oh, it's just horrible. And I'm not talking about politics here. I'm not about American politics. I'm saying in general, there's so many dictators in this world who have so many opportunities. And what do? They waste them. They could do so great, such great things, and they waste it. Just to hold on to a little bit longer. And then when they go, they die anyway. I mean, you know, and then one day they're forgotten. They, I don't know, develop a disease, you know, forget that they were presidents in the first place, and then they die, right? And they get a great funeral, but yeah, so what, right? I mean, honestly, if you think about this, so these are really the less fortunate people, right? Honestly, yeah. And so that's like suffering of the lower realms. I think, you know, that could be a suffering of someone in a lower kind of state, I would say. I mean, not a state I would want to be in if I have those kind of wrong views. And okay, and then there's refuge, okay? All right, refuge is a bit tricky. I mean, I know I do courses on refuge, and just a few people show up. That's also a topic right now. I don't want to talk about it, but this is something, if it's hard, it's very important. You know, there's something we can actually rely on. There's something we can take refuge in, you know, the teachings, but also in ourselves. It's also we take refuge in our future great abilities. And that's also beautiful, to gain more inner strength and self-confidence in our future, you know, greatness. Right now, it's not exactly there. The seeds are there, but, you know, we can take refuge in that. That's also very empowering. It gives us more self-confidence and keeps us going, right? Gives us joy when we're doing things to work towards that. And then the next topic is karma. Okay. Karma is not easy. Again, it's not easy. And we need to think about this, right? Need to think about this. But it's this idea that there's a natural law. It's kind of a natural law, like the law of gravity. It's said to be certain. Yeah? So whatever actions we accumulate will have results that are in accordance with these actions, right? And it kind of makes sense. We're all connected, right? We're interconnected. So what I give out, it kind of comes back to me, right? It's like what comes around goes around. I mean, yeah. So that idea, like the domino stone, kind of the domino thing, you know, it comes back. So that my actions have consequences. So again, that's very important, yeah? But also that whatever situation I am is the result of my past karma, okay? Now that is difficult. That's a very difficult one. It's difficult for anyone. It's difficult for Tibetans too, right? Difficult for Tibetans who are born in a culture where it's karma, 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 because usually we blame everyone else. We blame people around us. We blame the external for what happens to us. And there's, of course, there are external circumstances that lead to us, but the main cause lies in whatever we've done in the past. And the good thing about negative karma is that it ripens, and that's it. You know, at some point it's gone. We'll never come back. And we have all the power right now to make sure to form our own future. And feeling like a weak victim is so dangerous, so difficult. And I give you an example of like how I myself was in the Tibetan situation I was in with all these monks, right? And I need to say, I don't think they always tried to put me down. I mean, I had this feeling, I was like totally, what's the word, paranoid. The moment I said something, I felt, oh, they're just saying that because I'm a woman. Yeah. I mean, initially, I was put in a situation where women were treated differently by men. Yes, there was definitely that. But it was totally acceptable. I mean, the women didn't have a problem with that. I heard stories like, you know, like some of my nun friends would tell me, well, at home, when there was a man came in the room, my parents would always make sure, and they were lay girls at that time, that would always make sure that they sit on a higher chair, and I would sit on a lower chair, right? Wow, I had a problem with that one. Seriously. Boy, I thought, oh my God, these parents messed up their girls, or whatever. I had all these really strong... But then again, well, first of all, then... Oh, no, that's a different story. I mean, a lot of the times it was really good for my ego to get that bashing. You know, sometimes it was just good. I mean, how did it harm me sometimes having to walk behind a person? But it wasn't like there was also, of course, the idea this is not okay. But it was always mixed with, I have to do this. It was not so bad when the Tibetan nun had to do it. But when I had to do it, it was worse. So it was definitely, you know, that part. So it was like a mixture. But it went on and on, and there were a lot of things, and some of the things were just, Tibetans are just tough with one another. They don't use thank you very much, sorry, that much. They use it at times when I wouldn't use it, but at other times, you know, they don't say sorry at the same time. When you make a mistake, you don't say sorry. When you step on someone's foot, you do. But when you have like an argument and it's your fault, you don't say sorry, because it's like you're blowing it up again. So you don't say sorry. No one expects you to say sorry. And it's just a culture thing, right? What else? Other examples. Well, on the phone is kind of notorious. You have my classmates on the phone. Okay, so today we don't have class. And I'm like, hello? Hello? You still there? Gone already. They don't say goodbye. Right? So like, it's like certain things. It just took me a while to get used to it. So certain kind of gestures of thank you and so forth. They're just not there. So they're tough with one another. They also speak like that. Just come here. You know, they say that the more friendly they are, the less polite kind of things they say. So like, come here, sit down. What are you saying? Oh, it's just, they give a feeling, this. And they love us, and that's it. And then I have a cup of soup and, you know. Anyway, so they're very different in that way. Sometimes I misinterpreted it. I was like, oh, they're putting me down again. See how they talk to me. But actually, they talk to one another like that. So many examples. And sometimes it was real. You know, there are certain rules in certain monasteries we went to, and I just couldn't go to the debate. Because I was a woman, and I understood in the back, and I totally understood that this was not appropriate. I knew if I was the abbot, I would have stopped myself, you know, from but I still thought, how dare they? There was this other part of like, why me? And, you know, it was like this weird situation. So it went on for a long time. I felt like so disempowered and so frustrated. Until one day, I don't know what it was. I think his holiness must have said something, like one of my teachers, because it usually affects me stronger, talked about karma. And somehow I took it to heart. In a way, I had debated it for so long. I could do all the divisions and all the I could, you know, discuss it. I could give you advice on karma, but I could not do it myself. Until one day I thought, oh, actually that's the result of my karma. Yeah. So what would I have done to get there? And I could actually see myself. You know, I just kind of imagined in my mind being that overweight monk. These nuns should be in the back of the room. You know, I mean, it could have been, right? I mean, why? Who's to say it wasn't that? Who's to say it wasn't this macho was going around? And, you know, I had these experiences that were very real, and other people didn't have them. You know, it wasn't really like, they felt fine. They had no problem with me. They didn't understand. I couldn't speak with my Tibetan friends about it anyway, you know. So they're like, what are you talking about? They didn't feel it. But I felt very mistreated. And I thought, wow. And then I was like, it's okay. You know, it's actually okay. Not to say that I encourage, and you know, I'm still a strong feminist, but that hatred part, that frustration, that I could let go of. I still continue studying and show them I can do it, you know, I can show justice. That part never let, but that's a determination that comes out of joy. You know, it's like an acceptance and joy. I'll just, you know, this is just what happened to me, and for this lifetime, okay, I can't change it. Okay, but what are my disadvantages? What are my advantages? And I start seeing there are advantages. I mean, certain teachings I would get, my classmates wouldn't get. Right? I could go to certain teachers, and being the, you know, the nun, the only one in the class, you know. So they sometimes taught me, and they wouldn't teach my classmates. So it wasn't all bad, anyway. Right? I mean, it wasn't all bad. And so I had certain advantages, definitely, you know, different ones. So anyway, the point is that this acceptance was so great. And now it helps me in other situations. Something bad happens. Yeah, I go, oh, you know, and then someone says, you're Cameron, like, stop saying that, you know, I don't want to hear it. But it doesn't take as long as before to go, yeah, actually it is. You know, when the first frustration wears off, I can think, oh, actually it is. Okay. Right, okay, yeah. So now I can only make sure it doesn't happen again, right? So that's been very, very helpful. But it takes time. I mean, I want to, you know, be that kind of person that something horrible happens and I'm like, that happens. I'm like, it doesn't help. You know, it doesn't help. But now I'm not as unhappy as I used to be, as long for. So I shorten that time. And that's totally worth it. So to think of karma as in like, whatever happens to me, you know, it's a manifestation of the actions of the past. The external is also there, but they're just the circumstances. If I hadn't created the causes for that, this wouldn't happen. And whether that's just, you know, a bad hair day, no, I don't have those problems. But, you know, if it's for those of you who have bad hair days, it's just a bad hair day, well, that's also, you know, and it'll finish. The good thing about bad karma is that once it's ripened, you know, it'll at some point disappear and it's gone. It will not last forever. And so whatever karma has not ripened yet, I can purify. It's the other good thing about karma. So in this lifetime, I can do so much to make sure that whatever negativity is still there, I can purify that. There are certain practices that can be done. So I'm sure Geshe Gelug and so forth, you have great teachers here that can give you very extensive explanations on how to do that. And also just from now on, I can make choices. I can make sure I don't create that kind of action again in the future. So you see, it helps us. It's empowering. It's empowering, and it makes it easier to work, you know, to deal with everyday kind of difficulties, right? Yeah. And understand that's just a law, you know, like it's just a natural law. It's like, you know, it's like when you drop something, it falls to the ground. If I give out harm to others with the motivation to harm them, especially long term, some form of harm comes back to me. Yeah. And even little actions, I should not underestimate them, you know, even little ones, because it can expand. The negative karma can expand. Small positive actions, I should not underestimate, because they also expand. So little niceties, little, they're precious. Right? And then, of course, I could also think of more advanced topics. Emptiness or selflessness and bodhicitta. So even we do the beginner topics and maybe do those that we find most effective for our mind, but also take those into consideration to reflect upon how do I really exist? What is this self that feels hurt? What is the I? I've recommended this book already before. How to See Yourself as You Really Are by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. It's a great book. Can you read it like a novel? No, sorry. You probably want to take a page at a day. But it's, you know, you get through it in a half a year or maybe a year. You know, so take your time. It's got beautiful reasoning of like, what is the self? How does it exist? And it takes us through these reasonings. And it's just because we misunderstand what the I actually is. It all comes down to that misperception, right? The sense of this separate I. And the sense of the I, that controls all our actions. And it gives us so much suffering. From a Buddhist point of view, we're great people. We have great potential. We're beautiful. We have this incredible potential. But we have also a misperception that misguides us and makes us do things that actually harm us more than anyone else. So to undo that misperception is very, very helpful. So maybe to get that book and read through it. There's a Kindle version available, by the way. I know. There is. So if you don't want to carry so many books around, you can put it. So anyway, this is great material, just on reflecting on the... Yeah, I'll take question in a sec, yeah. And then also bodhicitta, you know, compassion, love. Lama Zopa Rinpoche has such beautiful books. I mean, I was asked to speak about them a little bit, but there's not that much time. But I've already kind of given the basis for that. You know, we're dependent on everyone else. We're not alone in the world. Everything we have, everything we knew, everything, you know, we are, all our good qualities come from others. Right? And so this interdependence, and we have something in common. We usually like people we have something in common with, right? For Americans, it's possibly, what is it? Maybe the same haircut, or like Westerners in general, the same haircut, the same taste. Not the same haircut, but like, you know, a certain style. Punk like punks, punk like punk, monk like monk. You know, like this kind of like, there's something you have in common. You know, like you wear a certain dress, you know, it's like you like to ride motorbike. You have like, you feel closer to these people. We look them out, right? In university, those who have the same taste when it comes to music. It's actually totally artificial. That's not an inherent reason why, because Tibetans don't do that. It does not matter which music you listen to. It doesn't matter what kind of jeans or not you wear. No, it depends on which area you come from. In Tibet, that's totally important. If you come from the same area, this person is your friend. If this person comes from Amdo, and then Amdo Golo or Amdo Ngawa, these are the different areas, these become your friend. And I asked my classmates, I said, like, how many friends do you have from different areas in Tibet? None. You know, it's just like, they look for a reason, and there's just a different reason. So it doesn't matter. It's just culturally determined. So basically, just need something you have in common with someone. And that is just depending on the culture. It's totally dependent on the mind, basically. So the culture has kind of made us do this, but it's actually coming from the mind. So what do we have in common with everyone? Everyone wants to be happy, and no one wants to suffer. So it's actually closeness. There's a bond between us. In terms of everyone, because the one thing, the most fundamental thing we know we have in common with everyone is that everyone wants to be happy and no one wants to suffer. Even the, what is it, sadist? Like, no, who are the people that harm themselves? Masochists. They get some satisfaction out of that. Right? Even a masochist gets something, and some pressure maybe is released. I don't know the psychology of that. But it's really like it gives them some satisfaction. So everyone is like that. We have that in common with everyone. So then our happiness is dependent on others' happiness. So might as well want them to be happy just like we want to be happy ourselves. And that's compassion, for others to be happy. Okay, anyway. So Lama Zopa Rinpoche gives this beautiful advice on how to practice bodhicitta, like how we can actually, you know, while we close the door, may I close the door to the suffering of all living beings, you know? When you brush your teeth, may this cleanse away any kind of problem and difficulty and depression of others. You know, may it be able to take them to enlightenment. You know, when you walk down the stairs, may I be now going down and take sentient beings out. I mean, I don't know all the different meditations Rinpoche does. And I don't know which book they're in, actually. So maybe someone of you. But there's so many books on that, on bodhicitta. And they're so beautiful. So you can actually brush your teeth and generate incredible virtue, incredible positive karma and compassion and so forth, right? So these two, the book by His Holiness on emptiness and, of course, Benama Zabrimish and other great masters and, you know, their advice on compassion and love. Those two, to also consider those. And then our practice becomes very complete, I would say. And our level, as Jitsuma Denzin Palmo explained, of happiness becomes, you know, higher. And then, you know, the bad stuff, we kind of pop back easier, right? And we're just more balanced and live a happier life, right? And then also make sure in the future we can continue like that and hopefully, you know, one day become enlightened, of course. Okay, now I'll take questions. I have 15 minutes left. There was a question right here, I believe. Someone raised their hand. Maybe just wait for the microphone. Sorry, I think. Yeah. Okay. Yes, please.
You had mentioned that these books that we should read are out on, you know, in various medias,
mm-hmm.
and that you can't read them like a novel.
Mm-hmm.
You read a little bit at a time.
Yeah.
An interesting thing to do is to add the audio books
mm-hmm.
to the visual book.
Okay.
So, although the Dalai Lama is not reading his books, some he has,
mm-hmm.
but if you can hear a voice talking to you like mm-hmm. you're listening, we're listening to you now,
mm-hmm.
at the same time you are actually reading the text,
mm-hmm.
it magnifies the experience,
mm-hmm.
And the publishers,
mm-hmm.
for the benefit of people who want to sometimes listen to it,
mm-hmm.
You talked about Kindle,
mm-hmm.
they will have an Audible version.
Oh, wonderful.
And then you can go over and read it on your phone or on your
great.
Various
yeah.
pads. But if you take it from the point of view that you could do that simultaneously, like doing they have Shanti Deva, and you can do that same thing.
Okay.
So even though you're only reading and listening to a small amount at one time,
mm-hmm.
it's just a completely different experience to
very
get
important,
it in
yeah.
multimedia.
Wonderful. This is great. I mean, yeah. So this is wonderful because here we have someone, I mean, the Buddha didn't speak about that. So this is like a 21st century kind of, you know, we gain our own experience and we share it with one another. And I think that's a wonderful advice to, you know, also when you listen to it, I think that's one of the ways to also listen. I was just reminded of that while you were saying it. Does this apply to me? How does this apply to me? Not kind of like, how does this apply to my neighbor? But how does this? That's another way also where it becomes a meditation actually. Yes, please.
Could you give me some pointers on prayer when it comes to Buddhism? I just don't get the concept of prayer and who you're praying to. I just never understood that.
That's.
I mean, in Christianity, it was easy.
You know. Right,
but
right.
In Buddhism, I don't know. You know, I don't know.
Okay, great, great. Wonderful question. The idea of prayer. Actually, I think there's kind of two entities that you address in a way. One entity is, I mean, they're already fully enlightened beings who are said to not be kind of trapped in just one situation or in just one location, but whose enlightened mind is all around. So they would perceive, you know, our request for help. And just asking for help, oftentimes, if of course also we have the karma to be helped, we receive help. It's almost like we request a doctor to help us, right? When we go to a doctor's office, then we request the doctor to help us and tell us what kind of medicine would, you know, so in that sense, like you ask the doctor what would be a good thing to do, and okay, you get an advice back in like everyday kind of life, but you still have to make that request. Of course, if I don't have the karma in that situation to be helped, okay, or maybe only little help. That could also happen. And sometimes they have the karma, so we need to try. Now, when we make prayers to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, not just Buddhas, but also Bodhisattvas, these are special beings who have special abilities that we have the seeds of those too, but we haven't been able to actualize this yet. They can perceive, they're aware of our thoughts, for example. So they're aware of that, and we make prayers, you know, help me that I will encounter, you know, I'll be able to receive these teachings or something. And it's said that they actually try within the confinements, if you like, of our karma to benefit us. That is one part. So there are actually beings who can benefit us. Like in other religions, they call them angels or, you know, whatever they call them. In Tibetan, in Buddhism, there are also these beings, highly realized beings possibly, even Buddhas, or other beings who are like, still have these abilities to benefit us. So that's the same as in Christianity. There's not much difference. So we want to call them angels or whatever, but these are these beings who can help us. But without asking for help, you know, we don't make that karmic connection with them. But you also pray because of the power of the mind. Because the power of the mind. So when you make a prayer, you put your mind in that direction. It's totally subconscious. We're not aware of that, right? So it's like certain things we want to do. Sometimes we make a prayer, may I have the strength to run this marathon, right? You know, if you put your mind in that sense and you really, I want to win this marathon. And then before you know, you actually do. Or like, you know, when you, I love the example of athletes. You know, like athletes, before they do, they go in their mind, I'm going to do this now. They put their mind in that situation in a very difficult, a gymnast, for example, very difficult movement they can suddenly do. So it's like you put your mind already in that situation. One day I'll be enlightened. May I become. So this is where your mind is heading to. Because you're putting really, other people can assist you, but it mainly comes from our own mind. So you're putting yourself already in that direction, right? Remove obstacles. I told this story, so some of you who were here before have heard this before. Being a nun, for example, there are a lot of obstacles, people say, and especially a Western nun, you know, there's so many obstacles. It's not easy. And so when I was ordained as a nun, and so many monks and nuns disrobe, especially Western monks and nuns, I don't know the percentage, but I'm sure it's around 50%, if not more. So there's so many obstacles, and then suddenly it hits you and you can't go on. So when I became a nun, we were like quite a few Westerners. I don't remember the exact numbers, between 8 and 10 or something, I forget. Anyway, so Lama Zopa Rinpoche said, this is a special celebration now at the big stupa in Kathmandu. Go and make prayers that you will not face obstacles. And somehow we were so petrified of experiencing obstacles. We did prayers the whole night, you know, we did lots of butter limb offerings and made these strong prayers. May we be able to face any kind of difficulties. And somehow, throughout all these years, you know, there were difficulties, but there was always, in the last moment, I could kind of get around it. You know, sometimes maybe not the last moment, but it was almost like I could slide through it. And everyone in my group is still a nun or a monk. I've never heard of this. There's so many people who disrobe. There may have been other people too, and I think Wendy has a story of that.
Yes, so of the six of us who were only Karen Baldwin is still a nun.
Ah, okay, Karen Baldwin, okay.
Uh-huh.
Right.
I also have the experience of being able to get around things, but at one point, psychologically.
Yeah, the obstacle was just true. Right, and so it was. Yeah, oh, I know Karen. She was one of my first teachers. Anyway, so. The point is that this is, I believe, the power of prayer, actually. And I've also continued with those prayers. So it's something like you actually direct your mind in the direction you want to go. Sorry, this was a long-winded kind of explanation, but it needed a little bit more. The power of prayer. It's really strong. So there's external entities you pray to, and yourself put your mind in that direction. Yeah, so this is important. I think that's why prayer is important. And it's a kind of meditation, too. Yeah, please.
The language.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to make a point on that, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
The language of prayer
mm-hmm.
is purifying in itself and uplifting and very beautiful.
Yes. Okay.
When you do that habitually, mm-hmm. you just automatically fall into that state of mind immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps you very much in meditation. The same
beautiful.
Goes for a ritual.
Mm-hmm.
It's not meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
You fall into a very positive state of mind, and it helps to push you
mm-hmm.
through in your meditation. So
wonderful. It's a meditation in itself.
Yes,
it's actually a meditation.
Very good.
Some of these prayers are like meditations that, you know, take you through the kind of thought processes. That's another point. I think that's what Wendy was basically saying. Yeah. Okay. More questions? But the good is to try it out first and then see. Yes.
I would like to know, what is your opinion about
mm-hmm.
people that suffer from like depression or mental illness, mm-hmm. and when they stressed out or when they go through thoughts of suffering, and they can help themselves.
Okay.
So it's a situation. Do you connect the karma with that? That they have a karma to feel suffer, to like they understand
mm-hmm.
that they are blessed, that they have those
mm-hmm.
positive things in their lives,
mm-hmm.
but they still can feel happy about it because it's something
right.
beyond.
Yes, I mean, it's from a Buddhist point of view, it is actions of the past, but that doesn't mean that it's permanent, you know. It can be changed. And people in the 21st century, actually, in a way, I think are very fortunate because there's medicine available. Sometimes medicine helps. If it's something that has to do with the body, medicine may help. I'm not totally opposed to that. Some people are, but I'm not, if it helps. Or they're incredible psychiatrists. So, like, if you have certain problems, you wouldn't want to go necessarily to a Tibetan Lama. I wouldn't try that. You know, because they don't have that kind of experience. So there's certain advice they can give that can also be taken, but they're incredibly wonderful, especially in this country, well-trained psychiatrists, and then, you know, try out different therapies. Mm-hmm. And when they're ready, then maybe as a third person, you could maybe introduce these ideas, and slowly. Mm-hmm. It's not permanent. It will change, but it may look like there's no solution right now for those people. But it will change eventually. But then I'm saying some of these techniques, they may not be, you know, applicable. It's difficult. But you can still advise them, you know, look at this good situation. Try and focus on that. And if they can just do it for 5 minutes, it gave them 5 minutes of some joy. And it saw some seeds. It can saw some seeds.
And there is a danger when you look at a karma.
Mm-hmm.
Like if some things happen to you that is negative and you blame on the karma and then you start self.
Okay.
Becomes
self-deprecating? Yes. And that's not the only danger.
Yeah.
Another danger, and that's, I'm glad you're bringing this up, is looking at other people suffering and go, that's their karma.
Okay.
No. That's not what karma is about. This needs to be said, and I usually say that today, I forgot. To understand karma, you see, if there's a situation someone is in, okay, in this situation it may be their karma, but this person may have the karma to be helped. My responsibility is to help that person. And if I'm in a situation, it's not like there's just one karma. There's karma ripening and going and ripening, and there's new things, you know, new things. So don't think of something permanent there. Mm-hmm. It's just little different results popping up, and then something else happens. And so within this, there's a lot I can do. So if there's a person suffering, it's like, you know, as a doctor, you see someone who has a disease, you can see it as a karma. They may have the karma to be cured or not. So we need to go and try out. And then be accepting if they can't be cured, all right, in that situation they can't be cured. In a different situation they may be. So don't think of it as like some solid, yeah. No. It's ever changing. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. That's important, yeah.
I heard that you mentioned about emptiness.
Uh-huh.
Would you explain it just a little bit more?
it's so nice you ask. And so I won't be able to. There's a book. Okay, so, this is a difficult book. That's a very good book, but it's a little difficult in the beginning. But maybe Geshe Gelig is teaching here. I'm sure he will teach it at some point. So, this is, unfortunately, there's not enough time to talk about it. But this book also, How to See Yourself as You Really Are by His Holiness, is also a good book on that. Yeah. In the very back. Yes, that's right, yeah.
Thank you. Would you be willing to say a few words about how you incorporate tantric meditation into your practice?
Which kind of meditation?
Tantric.
Ooh. Tantric meditation. Okay. I think it's good to understand that tantric meditation is very advanced. Very advanced. Actually, I don't think there are many people in this world who are qualified for practicing tantra. Which doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. To be fully qualified is one thing. But to know that it's good to do it in order to sow seeds. Right? So His Holiness Dalai Lama gives these high initiations. Sometimes there are thousands and thousands of people. How many people receive the initiation? Maybe one person. But that's okay. That's all right. Because actually to receive at least the high yogic tantric initiation, you must be a bodhisattva. The texts are very clear on this. So if you're a bodhisattva, you receive it. I know I'm not, so I don't receive it, but I don't worry about it. So to do those meditations, you know, if you've received an initiation, you should always ask your teacher what practice to do. Don't just go ahead, you know, oh, my friends take them, I should take this initiation. You should check with a teacher who tells you, you know, a qualified teacher who tells you what practice to do. And then, you know, I mean, you can read about this, like how to do them properly. You know, there's always commentaries. And then do them, try to do them on a daily basis, but that shouldn't be your main focus. The main focus should always be the Lambrim. Yeah. So to do them, there's no problem. To do them as thoroughly as you can, but don't worry about it. If it's not like, oh my God, I'm not getting any results, that's okay. Because for the time being, it's just to kind of sow these seeds, which is very important, but to still focus on the Lambrim. That would be my advice. Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Wow, perfect timing. It's 8:30.
If anyone would like to come and take a kata and make an offering, we can close with that, unless Venerable Lama, are the prayers that are normally said on Monday nights, or does anyone know?
I'd like to say
some prayers anyway. Great. You can present the kata while I'm saying the prayers. From the White Prayer Book, I'm going to say the prayers on the back of the first bay sheet. Saji Perki Shushing Metok Tamri Ratna Mandala Kam Niryataya.